talk this evening on a wonderful piece by Hongzhi that's entitled The Acupuncture Needle of Zazen. It's a short piece, but it's a piece of real importance and has enormous implications for practice. So it begins as follows. The essential function of all Buddhas, I'll just read it through completely. The essential function of all Buddhas, the functional essence of all ancestors, is to know without touching things and illuminate without encountering objects. Knowing without touching things, this knowledge is innately subtle. Illuminating without encountering objects, this illumination is innately miraculous. The knowledge, innately subtle, has never engaged in discriminative thinking. The illumination, innately miraculous, has never displayed the slightest identification. Never engaging in discriminating thinking, this knowledge is rare without match. Never displaying the most minute identification, this illumination is complete without grasping. The water is clear right down to the bottom. Fish lazily swim on. The sky is vast without end. Birds fly far into the distance. So, the essential function of all Buddhas, the functional essence of all ancestors, is to know without touching things and illuminate without encountering objects. Now when he speaks of all Buddhas and the functional essence of all ancestors, on the surface, one might think he is speaking of his predecessors along the path of transmission. And while that is not untrue, it would be irrelevant to simply be commenting on things that were in the past and building one more story about the miraculous powers of these creatures called Buddhas and ancestors. But the basic teaching of the Buddha, of course, is that he realized upon awakening that all beings are endowed with this quality, which got to be known as Buddha nature. So the essential function of all Buddhas, the functional essence of all ancestors, is our own essential function, our own essential essence. If it is realized, if it is made real, it is not something to be acquired, as everybody practicing Zen knows, but rather something to be unveiled, revealed. And so the process of Zazen is a process of exploration. It is not a process of following a delineated path in order to arrive at a goal. That is, in comparison to this work, simple. And it is certainly highly valued and applicable within the realm, we say, of samsara, that is, in pursuing our own individual karma according to our position in the great karmic fabric. But all of this position that we have, all this great karmic fabric, is itself the laboratory, the domain of this exploration for our essential nature. Our essential functioning. It is not something that is done, you know, when that other work is completed, whenever we have time. And to find that in every moment a time of this investigation, this exploration, is indeed to get down closer and closer to the real essence of practice. So, we to realize that he is speaking then of us, of everyone. But speaking not just of our surface appearance or our position in a karmic fabric, but of the essence of our being, which, as he says, it is the essential function of all Buddhas to manifest. It is, as we say in our teaching, the one word. So he says that it is to know without touching things and illuminate without encountering objects. So what does that mean? Is it really worth investigating what that really means? It does not, of course, mean separating oneself from touching the world. One needs to have a little bit of, how do we say, spiritual intelligence or some kind of quality of resonance with these words in order to intuit and get closer to the actual meaning intended by Hongxin. So not touching things and encountering objects. How can this be knowing and illumination? This is an essential point. Now, touching things or encountering objects, of course, is the thing that most people do, in the sense that their life is lived within the presupposition of self and other, oneself as a perceiving, acting entity, and objects or things upon which these actions take place. And the hunger of the mind to any time it encounters any new phenomenon, to rush right in and name it and try to explain it and put it in through the filters of one's being to see if it, quotes, makes sense, and all these kinds of activities of mind. And what Hongzhi is saying is this activity, if suspended, not, of course, if denied, as we always say, it's a very valuable quality, but suspended. That is, knowingly coming into charge or control of the way the mind operates is essential to getting underneath and allowing this functional essence of Buddhas, which is our innate nature, to manifest itself in our life. Touching objects and encountering things. So, it is a matter of when we are sitting or when we are going through the world, to be mindful, to not be fooled. Of what, though? Of what? Of the tendency of mind to assume certain things and to allow a dropping away of that almost robotic tendency to identify something, to name it. Rather, one must allow it simply to be. Simply to be. In other words, if we use the idea of the Japanese nin, we are like a layer of onions, and the third nin is where we have related everything to some story in our mind and some set of recollections and associations. That, in the process of Zazen, needs to be peeled off. It needs to be suspended. We need to free ourselves from the automatism of that activity. Well, then we get to the next layer, which is to refer to self. The story may not have all have started, but the self, there is an encounter of the self. I see, I hear some object. Allowing that to be known, to just perceive that, to see, this is what the mind does. If you notice in people in conversation, and certainly perhaps yourself also, that when you hear something, the first tendency is to comment on it with respect to oneself. Well, I wouldn't do that. It refers to just observe what you do, and observe what people do. There's this reference to self. And then there's the building into the third nin of all these stories that go with it, and that reminds me of, and so on. This is simply how the mind operates. But we in Zazen need to see that. And we need to come out of the victimhood of that process and allow things to just be. and not to rush in with our favorite approach to things that might be finding a solution or whatever it is, but to notice that and to find when it might be appropriate and when it's better to just let things be. And certainly in the practice of Zazen, it would be universal to let things be, to learn the art of that, to get familiar with it, so it is not subdued by the automatism of having to rush out and create stories about associations with things, and to name things, and to refer to oneself, and all that. Self and other mutually define each other, as it says in the Shinshin Ming. So this is an important part of subtle, and Hongzhi uses the word subtle later, of subtle practicing day to day. So now then one goes beyond that, underneath that, and lets go of the idea of having to name things. What does naming do? It creates a certain familiarity, a certain, this is my home, understand things, certain comfort, a certain ease, but it also prevents something he speaks of later, which is the miraculous. But we have to go underneath that, to the place where we encounter things, and it is just the experience of that thing, and then Hongzhi is inviting us to go beneath that. When you go beneath that, this requires a certain effort in practice. And the effort in practice is to notice the tendency of the mind. That's all you have to do. You don't have to work at it. You don't have to try to match an ideal or anything. You just have to notice what the mind is doing. That is to say, to notice what mind is doing, not what you are doing, for there is no you fundamentally. But just what mind is doing, without having to work on is it your mind or all this silliness. Just notice. And that noticing itself is a royal solvent. As the old alchemists used to call it, the aqua regia, the royal water. And it dissolves all those structures that almost are built automatically and shield us from this direct encounter. We say direct encounter, that implies that there is someone encountering something, but this is the end of words. We use those words for we have no other way to speak of it. We have no other way to transmit and excite and inspire that particular way of being in the world. That is to say, in relationship to oneself, you might say, but it is really in relation to Buddha nature, but it is really not in relationship to anything. There is no reference point. So we have to say those words. It is not in relationship to anything, although it is an encounter, and there is no reference. We have to say those things because we have no other way. Merely to point at something, merely to hold an object in one's hands and hold it silently, the way the Buddha held up the flower before the assembly, where Kashyapa smiled, is not enough for our kind of interactions. It requires a great amount of resonance to be able to simply hold it up and to have that resonance that allows what has come to be known in Zen as the transmission to occur. So we need to talk of words, helps, in order to move along to the point where this level of subtlety is experienced. Finally, this level of subtlety becomes so unavoidable and so obvious that it is really the whole world. And it is no longer subtle in the sense of being hard to find, and but rather it is the simply the fact, the essence of things. And then out of that place can come the discriminating mind and the acting mind and the activities of the four Jhani Buddhas and everything else. So Hongzhi is urging us, and this is almost like secret doctrine. This is almost like the core that he dares to put out here, hoping that there will be enough resonance in some of his readers, hearers, and doubtlessly it was spoken first, to light a spark, maybe, whatever image works. So, encountering objects, he has those qualities to it. And to, when you really learn how to be in the presence of what you previously called objects, but letting them all be so subtly and completely, completely, that you're not letting any particular named thing be. For they have all, you have let go of their names and their delineation as separate from anything else. They become like, as an image he uses near the end, they become like fish lazily swimming through the clear water. There is a transparency about the world. A transparency. And I mean that word, transparency. As though all things within this transparency arise, waft away the way the mists of morning do. They take form and then they change, dissolve and fall away. Carpets and people and ideas and thoughts, great things and lesser things and buildings and grass and trees, they take form and they dissolve. That kind of transparency. But not within a time dimension. Just right now. Right now there is this transparency. So he says, knowing without touching things, this knowledge is innately subtle. Now, what does subtle mean? One use of subtle, we speak of subtle energies. These are maybe just beyond at the edge of our currently available measuring instrumentation. Or they are not immediately experienced. If we apply these ideas, what is the measuring instrumentation? It is our accustomed mode of operating with our mind, with its discriminations, identifications, with its addiction to self and other. The reason we don't experience this knowing, this knowledge, if we want to use that term, this awareness, this fundamental nature of our being, we say our being, but we really mean being, is that we have filters up. So it is not, this subtlety is not a quality so much of the reality that we are stretching to realize, but rather it is a quality of the way in which we armor ourselves in such a way that it is not very easy for us to realize it. The subtlety is a result of our activity, our creation, our mode of attempting to understand the world. So therefore he implies we have to suspend that. Suspend it. Then it becomes less subtle. It finally becomes very evident. Now when it becomes evident, as he says, illumination without encountering objects, this illumination is innately miraculous. Innately miraculous. Now, what is a miracle? We can say a miracle is something that defies explanation. It's not understandable within the current structure of cause and effect. But things that make sense. Something that we don't immediately have the ability to explain. Another thing about miraculous is it demands attention. We don't just say, oh, yeah, one more miraculous thing. So, wow, miraculous thing, and we are attentive to it. There are a number of things about this word and the experience that we human beings have when we use the word miraculous or miracle. So it is in that sense, not in the sense that it is unusual, innate in itself, but it is unusual because we are so, once again, armored in a motive floating through the world that it renders it very unlikely that we will actually perceive that which is our fundamental nature. So when there is some insight into it, or some flash of it, or some approach to it, when we get touched by it, or we experience the emanation of it, it seems like it's miraculous. Merely because there is a chink in our armor, not because it itself is kind of an odd and rare thing, which also is a function of the way people use the word miracle ordinarily. So this is a very important thing. This all refers to what we do to ourselves automatically, unwittingly, robotically. And to see into that and allow that to drop away. Allow it to be suspended so that something becomes possible for us, which is the very source of our life. So he says, this knowledge, innately subtle, has never engaged in discriminative thinking. This illumination, innately miraculous, has never displayed the slightest identification. Now we speak of two things here. Discriminative thinking, which means a thinking, which is the basis of the understanding of the word and process of thinking, is it implies that it works within the domain of discriminated objects, discriminated thoughts, discriminated feelings, discriminated before and after. It's discriminated things. It is objects, things that are worked with in relationship to each other, to see how they build upon each other, how they relate to each other, how they're causally related, or how the consequences can lead to other things in a predictable future, and things like that. That is what is called thinking. But underneath it, the presupposition of it is this reliance, first of all, upon a mode of knowing that is called understanding, but that is based on the manipulation of objects, and that is based upon fundamentally this dualistic mind, the habit of the dualistic mind. Homashi urges us to put that into suspension. He says it has never engaged in discriminative thinking. That is to say, that fundamental nature of us does not engage in discriminative thinking. That's an important key. When you watch your mind engaging in discriminative thinking, then notice that. And just the mere noticing and letting it be is applying this solvent to allow you to move, we say, underneath it, but allows it to drop away as a piece of armoring, piece of something that you think you need in order to be in the world. And then he says, the illumination innately miraculous has never displayed the slightest identification. Now this identification is very important, because very often in our Zen work we will experience certain things, and we will perhaps experience the very close affinity and that we might almost say identification with. And very often people will, when they have a depth of insight into things through their Zen practice, will say, I am the tree. And certainly many koans urge a person to come to that level of realization. I am the tree, I am the path, I am the grain of sand. I am the sky and the clouds scudding through it. That is what I am. And this, of course, is very wonderful. Until the habit of identification that comes from the hunger to know who and what one is, the habit of identification takes over and says, finally, I've solved it. That's what I am. And immediately a solidity arises, and a new kind of armor develops that was originally a depth of insight. But if left at that, that's why I say when practicing, see all these things as mere scenery along the way. Do not linger with them. Do not make them solid. Do not make them anything that continues to define a self or put gold stars upon this self. Or give oneself the satisfaction of finally understanding something. Put doubt into everything. And let it be. That means you have to trust the other of the great three pillars of Zen, which are always operating, is trust. If you trust enough, you'll know you don't have to grasp it. You don't have to hold on to that great experience. For it was merely a window into something that is will finally be your common way of living. For fundamentally, that's what it is. And the practice of Zen is coming to know that innately. And you have to put things into doubt. That is to say, not stop. Not start building. Not start holding on to. Not start identifying. Not letting it be. Letting it be. Letting it be. And of course, you have to persist. For once you undertake this, what we call the path, you got to realize finally there is no other work. You have to continue along it in a manner of speaking. So it's always applicable, these great three pillars. So this identification, one of the most mysterious things about us human beings, and many mysterious things about us human beings, that are some of it robotic, but this division that we have, and this hunger that arises out of the division. As the Buddha said, the basis of suffering is this desire. It is the desire to bridge this, to heal it. And that great Chinese, whoever he was, source of wisdom that designed the character for the Buddha in Chinese, showing a person standing beside two things bound together, healed, is the function of the Buddha. That is to say, addressing one of the essential factors of us human beings, this division. And this identification, we experience it. We sometimes call it stickiness or glue, Velcro of the mind. But we can't really describe it. We can't stand outside. It is an essence of our nature that drives us on to find something underneath. And if we go the other direction, it builds a structure that we can identify with, which is always susceptible to the erosions of time, as the Buddha pointed out. For nothing is permanent, nothing is graspable, final. So we have to go the other way, the way of letting it be, the way of noticing and letting it be, and getting continually involved in the exploration of what this is to be a human being, an encounter in this place and that place, this process which we call, for want of some other word, the glue, the identification, the thing that stops the flow, that builds an edifice, rather than letting it continue to dissolve. It's a strange kind of thing in this upside-down kingdom, that the entropy that we fear, nothing permanent and all that sort of thing in the samsaric world, is the very thing that allows us liberation, this dissolution of solidity. Allows us liberation. So this illumination, innately miraculous, has never displayed the slightest identification. Never engaging in discriminating thinking, this knowledge is rare without match. Rare. There are certain stamps in the world, for example, that are very rare. When I used to collect stamps as a kid, I always was fascinated by the fact that there were a couple of stamps of which they knew only one example in the world. One. And of course, everybody's looking for a second one. It may turn up in somebody's attic somewhere. And of course, it's worth a fortune. merely because it's rare. The fact about this is that it is our nature, but the encountering with it is rare because of the momentum, juggernaut of robotic behavior that is essential, part of the essential nature of us human beings, that we encounter as we do our zazen. This is a wonderful, wonderful description. It is not as though it doesn't, it's not like the rare stamp, for example. It only seems like the rare stamp because it's encountered so infrequently, and that's just because of the habitual nature of the rest of it. Once we see through that, and this is the use of the discriminative analytic mind in the practice of Zen, in my opinion, it is a necessary preface. It's very much like in the time of Wei Nong, the gradual preparation for sudden enlightenment. Wei Nong received the mantle of the patriarchy because he realized that these things don't exist, finally. You drop them away, there is no dust, there is no mirror. But the head monk at the monastery was propounding the gradual preparation, the gradual clearing of the mirror, the gradual acquiring of understanding. Now, it is not as though one is against the other, for they really work hand in hand. And the necessary preparation is to see through how our mind works, how the dualism manifests itself, how we are imprisoned by the products of that, and what the nature is in our experience of identification. And to become so aware of that that we can automatically see it as we encounter it in our lives. And as we simply see it and let it be, then it starts to dissolve and we start to gain access to this miraculous transparency of the world, which is to start coming into knowing what we really are. So he says, never displaying the most minute identification, this illumination is complete without grasping. In other words, the world is, ordinarily the world of samsara is a world of grasping. And grasping arises out of the being impaled upon the two horns of duality. And letting all of that be allows that to drop away as the nature of our activity in the world. And thus the basis of suffering drops away. Not by any of the means of imagining and matching the imagination, the way some spiritual paths advocate, indeed some with the name of Buddhism advocate. No, it is not that. Zen dares to say, efficacious though those may be to have some reduction in the nature of suffering and so on, they are erecting a barrier. Because they are saying that the way to come to know who one truly is and what the nature of this world is can be gained access to through a dualistic path. And this is a pernicious teaching from the viewpoint of the holders of the fundamental core of the teaching of the Buddha. So I would say that some people who advocate that may be doing good things for folks that may not be ready. I don't know whether that's true or not. But what I do know is in the essence of Zen, and that the path towards the certain realization of this thing, any path based upon duality has to be seen through and let go completely. Thus we need a certain kind of courage. But what kind of courage is it when you're not going to fall and get hurt? Where there is no place to fall, nor anybody to get hurt. So what kind of courage is it? It is the essence of being a human being, of being confident in one's being, of being, as they say in Yiddish, being a mensch. The finally, he says, the water is clear right down to the bottom. Once you see these things, what is there that obstructs things? For the obstruction is created by us. It is not innate in the world. There is no fun. There is no suffering fundamentally. There is no bad thing or good thing. There is no mistake. There is no obstacle. Everything dissolves, and fish lazily swim on. What's the significance of lazily? Well, what's the opposite of lazily? Frantically? Hurriedly? With intention? Yes. Is not that based upon trying to get something? There's nothing frenetic about it. The sky is vast without end. Birds fly far into the distance. It's an expression of great freedom. With that essence of oneself, there are no barriers. So you see what a wonderful gift to us is this acupuncture needle of Zazen. And if you know what an acupuncture needle is like, it's very thin. And when it penetrates, you hardly recognize it. It is so thin, it goes almost between the cells, producing no damage. But the function of it, to want to oversimplify things, but part of the function of it is to balance the flows within the being so that things that were obstructions now are liberated from that obstruction. So that the healthy, normal, want to put it, flow of one's being can be restored. And thus pathology healed. It's a very appropriate title for this little piece we're in there tonight.